You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the April 2022 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part A. Here's the continuation of this month's cover story, Planet Grimes, by Devin Gordon. We're approaching hour three of talking, and beer three. Why is sound asleep upstairs? But at the same time, I can physically observe her brain cells saying, screw it. Like, bro wouldn't even get a new mattress. This was back when they were both living in Los Angeles. Her side of the mattress had a hole in it. When she raised the issue, he suggested they replace his mattress with the one at her house. The mattresses are fine now. Still, bro does not live like a billionaire. Bro lives at times below the poverty line. To the point where I was like, can we not live in a very insecure $40,000 house where the neighbors like film us and there's no security? And I'm eating peanut butter for 8 days in a row. She is well aware that many see Musk as some embodiment of luxurious excess, and Grimes is here to tell you she effin' wishes. This home in Austin could be any house in any upscale neighborhood. It's got a gorgeous view of the Colorado River in the back, and a tiny pool that she has no plans to use because she's not a big fan of sun. It's a nice house. It's no Versailles. I'm not super into amenities, she says, but I need nutrition and stuff. Grimes often describes her music as post-internet because the entire history of sound is just a click away, from Nine Inch Nails to Hildegard von Bingen's 12th century chanting and Stravinsky to Mariah Carey's daunting octaves, ready for her to pluck, bend, shape, and morph. If you fall into the category of people who'd never heard of her until she met Musk, 2015's Kill vs. Mame, one of the biggest hits of her fourth album, Art Angels, is the perfect four-minute crash course. It's a pulsing, menacing dance-punk rager, told from the perspective of Michael Corleone in The Godfather Part II, only in the Grimes remix, he's a gender-fluid vampire wrestling with a moral conundrum. Just your garden-variety pop disquisition on the nature of man and the inexorable pull toward brutality and chaos. Kill vs. Mame has been streamed 72 million times on Spotify alone. Decades from now, it'll still sound like a revolution. Book one remains a work in progress, but the 15 songs Grimes has got so far represent her most audacious work yet. Each song its own planet of sound. Crisp California pop, club shakers, arena anthems, ethereal requiems, fairy core. The album takes place in the distant future, at a stage of technological advancement when you can upload your consciousness into a robotic body and essentially live forever as a Cymec. In the parlance of science fiction aficionados, I feel like Jeff Bezos is going to be a Cymec, says Grimes. Her space opera's anti-hero is a Cymec she calls the Dark King, the world's greatest engineer, whom Grimes featured in the video for her recent single, Player of Games. By the time our story begins, he's pushing 10,000. Grimes is still hammering out the plot, but one key thread is a kind of cyberpunk spin on Swan Lake. There's a white swan, an exaggerated version of Grimes, the Dark King's dream girl, a simulated courtesan who grows weary of being a muse, and there's a black swan, an AI menace who wreaks havoc in the simulation. Except in Grimes' feminist reboot, The Swans ditch the Simek, fall in love, and fight for each other instead. From there, it gets kind of complicated. "Despite all my rage, I am still just a doll in a cage," she sings, paying homage to Billy Corgan of the Smashing Pumpkins, heroes of her wilding teens. Book one is Grimes's melancholy and the infinite sadness, with a hint of lemonade, and it was partly inspired by a theory of Musk, that she's a simulation. We keep having this conversation where E's like, "Are you real? Or are we living in my memory? And you're like a synthesized companion that was created to be my companion here." If this sounds like he's asking her if she's a virtual pleasure bot, that's not entirely what he means. Anyway, she says, she's never felt entirely real herself. "The degree to which I feel engineered to have been this, like, perfect companion is crazy." Does she mean the perfect companion for him, specifically? Yes, even just studying astrophysics and neuroscience. And it's really annoying because people think I'm an airhead who went to art school. She actually wanted to, but it was too expensive. A conversation with Grimes can be like staring at a Tokyo subway map when you don't speak Japanese. She's always using scientific terms and alluding to heady concepts, then checking with me to make sure I know what they mean, because usually I do not. If there's an airhead in this room, it's not her. "Do you know what a protopia is?" "No. A state of gradual progress toward utopia." "Effective altruism?" "I mean, I know what those words mean. Using data analysis to maximize resource deployment to help others." "The Overton window?" "I thought so, but I looked it up while she was in the bathroom, and I was wrong. The spectrum of accepted discourse and achievable ideas." "What about neuroplasticity?" "Now I'm worried she just thinks I'm stupid." Grimes was raised as a strict Catholic, which she struggled with, though she loved the spectacle of church. The Old Testament was like an ultra-violent blockbuster. Biblical manga. She spent year one of the pandemic taking care of X and plunging down a rabbit hole of Homer, the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle, the Icelandic sagas. An idea began to form. A space opera about the galaxy-altering events unfolding before her eyes, in which she has become an unwitting participant. A love story about some epic stuff. The future of civilization. Simulated protopia. The dawn of creative AI. Terraforming Mars. Here was a golden opportunity to pry open that Overton window, Grimes style. "The idea of the female Herodotus," she says, "almost doesn't exist." Grimes isn't just the narrator, though. She's also a principal character, and over the course of written history, her archetype, the lover, the siren, the mistress, hasn't been treated with much respect. Book one alludes to Athena, Calypso, Persephone, the Black Swan, Anne Boleyn, courtesans, concubines, geishas. "These weren't just hot girls," she says. "They were the smartest girls, some of the most educated women of their time. They painted, sang, designed their own clothing. They were the Grimeses of their day. And then they got written into history as some rich guy's side piece. I ate my cake. I lost my head. Villain of the internet," Grimes sings on a police-inflected track from Book 1 called Marie Antoinette 2077. "I'm super inspired by the way women get pulled into orbits in this manner," she tells me. "There's this weird dismissal of them. These are some of the most interesting characters in history to me, and they're so demeaned. I feel like the most radical thing I could do right now is just become Marie Antoinette." She considers it for a second. "Infamy is kind of fun." She quickly adds that she doesn't want this to become all about Musk. She says it often during our conversations, and she's referring to this article, but she could just as easily be referring to her life. The culture took sides on Grimes from the moment the couple appeared at the Met Gala in 2018. Their incongruous outfits, her looking like an interstellar Elvira, him wearing a prim white jacket, became an instant mismatch meme. Her Instagram mentions turned into a cesspool. She'd go on social media and defend herself. Guess how that went? It killed me at first, she says now. I spent 10 years effing producing, writing, engineering, every single effing thing on my own, and I effing proved myself. Her friends are still furious on her behalf, more for the erasing than the hating. It frustrates me because she's as brilliant as him, says Barry. When I see her referred to as the significant other of another person, it's like, oh, come on. Over the years, Grimes has slyly rebelled. She let the paparazzi catch her in a Dune-inspired bodysuit and leggings while ostentatiously reading the Communist Manifesto. She lampooned her cyber nymph persona by posting her self-care regimen on Instagram. I spend 2 to 4 hours in my deprivation tank. This allows me to astroglide to other dimensions, past, present, and future. About half of the pop culture galaxy thought she was serious. Until the day she dies on Mars, legitimate media outlets will be reporting that she had experimental surgery to remove blue light from her visual spectrum. In other words, rebellion didn't work. Grimes also started to feel unexpectedly conflicted about her role in this theater. For one thing, she liked being Musk's girlfriend. She knows she's going to get slaughtered for saying this, but personally, I don't think Manic Pixie Dream Girl is an insult. I exactly identify with all of those terms. I understand it's supposed to be a critique of certain things, but then I challenge that critique. She began to reject what she calls this misplaced idea of feminism, of like, I need to be my own thing, I need to be separate. She has kids with Musk. Separate is off the table for good. There's no way to extricate myself, she says now. So she did what artists do. She turned her gilded cage into source material. According to her little brother, Mac, the Boucher's childhood in Vancouver was like Stranger Things, minus the Demogorgon. Kids in nearly every house on the street. Secret clubs in the basement. Bikes. Vancouver is also a port city, though, with lots of crime and pretty much every drug that enters Canada. By high school, they had more or less graduated from Stranger Things to Euphoria. I was like a mix of Jules and Rue, Grimes says, referring to the Euphoria characters played by Hunter, Schaefer, and Zendaya, respectively. That sounds about right, says Mac. In other words, she was a hyper-smart, thrill-seeking, gender-exploring time bomb, whose hobbies included rejecting capitalism, partying too hard, and dancing until sunrise. Though Mac notes that she was also an overachieving straight-A student, politically radical, and deeply involved with what was then called the Gay-Straight Alliance. She tried LSD for the first time when she was 13, and has lost multiple friends to opiate overdoses. She would pay for drugs by doing homework for Taiwanese loan sharks. Mac, who is 2 years younger, got involved in sports instead, and he sounds almost amazed that he was the younger sibling. She was always doing what he calls dumb Claire shit. He asked if she told me about the houseboat. Yes, she did. That was one of the first adult choices she made. The euphoria phase was less about defiance, Grimes says, and more about DNA, particularly that of her grandfather on her father's side, whom she describes as crazy and jarringly unwoke. My grandpa is hard as F, she says. He grew up in poverty, super anti-establishment, teach yourself. Don't rely on other people to teach you anything. She says he taught her how to shoot guns when she was 6. Grimes' parents divorced when she was around 11, and her mother married a man with 2 sons, bringing her brother count to 4. Her grandpa nursed her competitive fire. You gonna let your brothers defeat you? Being outnumbered by the boys has never fazed her since. She says he taught her to drive a standard transmission by instructing her to reverse the car to the edge of a cliff. If she lets the car roll backwards, she says, recalling it now, we're literally going to die. She won't be forcing teenage X to pop a clutch or die trying. He'll be in a self-driving Tesla, presumably. And anyway, she won't have to thrust X and Y into brutal test of their mettle. Just being the children of Grimes and Elon Musk will be enough of a barrage, and the shields never seem to hold. It's going to be hard for them, she says, in a different way. Grimes' grandfather is still alive and still lives like a hermit in remote British Columbia. Once he gave her some professional feedback. You really need to sex it up. You should be more like Miley Cyrus. He was like, your career is going to be way better if you start showing more skin, she recalls. I was like, Grandpa. Grimes' first record was a Dune-inspired concept album called Guidy Primes, a reference to the militaristic planet ruled in the recent movie by an enormous Stellan Skarsgård. She dubbed herself Grimes because MySpace allowed her to associate herself with 3 musical genres, and she liked the name Grime, then a nascent British music scene. Her father read Frank Herbert's book to her when she was 4. She loved it. At one Met Gala, she cornered Sting, who starred in David Lynch's much-derided adaptation, and freaked him out with a heavy dose of Dune fangirling. For years, Grimes harbored a dream of directing her own adaptation of Dune, with the more problematic colonialist elements scrubbed out. But when she heard about Denis Villeneuve's 2-part blockbuster, she fangirled all over again and signed on to help with the rollout, originally scheduled for November 2020. I was basically an influencer. And then, she adds, she got canceled from Dune because of the Communist Manifesto thing. She was crestfallen, but she understood. There are things that are deeply not woke in the Dune universe, she says, so the studio had to be extra cautious, and she was far from indispensable. When she finally saw the movie, she realized, to her astonishment, that this story she'd adored since she was far too young for it, that she knew almost by heart, that inspired her first album, this story was now her story. Specifically, Lady Jessica's story. This goes by fast on screen, but Jessica, played by Rebecca Ferguson, is not a wife, but a concubine. Grimes saw herself in Jessica, and she saw X in Jessica's son, Paul Atreides, Timothy Chalamet. Paul is more than a duke's son. He's a chosen one, tasked with becoming a great leader. When I see X, she says, like, I just know X is going to have to go through all this really effed up shit that sort of mirrors Paul-type stuff. Watching it wrecked her. I was just crying my eyes out the whole movie. She knows this might sound absurd. Grandiose. She wishes it felt that way to her, too. I feel like there's very few people in the world who could have similar sentiments about their son than Claire with X. Max says, when I relay this to him. I ask if it's surreal to watch his sister live this life. Yes, he says, laughing. But I'm also not really surprised, because she somehow always gets into the most insane possible scenarios. By the summer of 2019, Grimes was in the early days of her romance with Musk, and getting canceled online for it. And she was also finishing Miss Anthropocene, her long, long-awaited follow-up to Art Angels, all while her longtime manager and closest daily confidant was dying of cancer. Her life, she says, has always been level 10 chaos. This was level 11. She'd been making everything by herself for a decade, and she was sick of it. She needed to figure out a new way to be an artist, which meant figuring out a new way to make money being an artist. "I hate touring and I hate selling merch," she told her new manager, Dota Leonard, during their first FaceTime call. He laughs at the memory. If you know anything about being a manager in the music industry, at this point, most managers would have hung up. Instead, he said, "Cool, you're going to tour in the metaverse, and you're going to sell digital assets, digital goods. Okay, problem solved." They got to work creating an avatar of her body, dubbed War Nymph, and in February 2021, Grimes became among the first musicians to sell an NFT collection of digital artwork, some with accompanying music. Mac's idea. She generated $6 million from that one drop, more than she's ever made from any of her albums. They engineered a deepfake of her voice that she plans to release with other IP inside metaverse experiences and gaming platforms like The Sandbox, a sort of open-source creative experiment. "Look at fanfic," she says. "So much inventive stuff is happening there, if you know where to look." She has similar plans for an AI girl group she's designing named NPC, which is gamerspeak for non-player character. She puts the AI girl group out into the world. You go make something with it. The NFT project was so lucrative that if it had happened 2 weeks earlier, Grimes says, she might not have signed her first major label deal with Columbia Records. "No shots at Columbia," she adds. "They've been great. But she only did it to play for the ambitious videos she had in mind. The one for Shinigami Eyes, a futuristic dance-pop phantasmagoria, was among the first music videos filmed on an extended reality, XR, stage, similar to what was used to make The Mandalorian. Of course, signing with a major label was considered yet another betrayal by the Grimes purist, but where they see a sellout, she sees creative liberation. You sign with a label, any label of any size, for money, which you can either put into your pocket or plow back into the mission. The foot traffic is heavier the next afternoon when I return to Grimes's house, including little X. He arrives about 30 minutes after his mom and I have settled back into the anime nook, and as he charges through the door, she leaps to her feet with a delighted yelp. He says a friendly hi to me and later makes a bid for her laptop, so he can watch My Neighbor Totoro, Miyazaki's classic, with the giant cat bus. In solidarity with all the new moms out there, Grimes is wearing the same outfit as yesterday. She hasn't touched her makeup. Respect. While she gets X on his way for a playdate, I take in the view of the Colorado River from the living room. I look down and see a neat pile of picture books. And at the bottom, Time's Person of the Year issue with X's father on the cover. The room is dominated by a massive red couch, shaped like a giant Tootsie Roll, and it looks amazingly comfortable. But the kids have done a number on it, possibly both numbers, so Grimes sits cross-legged on the floor instead, and we discuss the elephant of the year in the room. We live in this society right now, where people expect everyone to behave right and talk right, she begins. You have these manifestations of genius, but then you want them to behave normally. But the reason they're like that is because they're so disconnected from correct behavior. Humans are beautiful and toxic in equal supply, she says. Like, we F up. We're all going to do bad things in our life. We're all going to do stupid things. She's talking about Musk. But once again, she could be talking about herself. They're both such deeply original thinkers, says Liv Burry, whom Grimes drafted to co-star as her black swan in the video for a Book One track called 100% Tragedy. The lines blur with them about whether it's even art versus engineering or science, because really we're talking about creating something that does not exist. From the moment they stepped out at the Met Gala, every PR mess Musk created calling an explorer who helped in the Thailand cave rescue a pedo guy, tweeting that pronouns suck, which elicited a pained, now deleted reply from Grimes, referring to Elizabeth Warren as Senator Karen, has turned into a referendum on Grimes. "When you hate me, think it fixes you to break me," she sings on book one. "I'll never fight you back because everything you hate is everything I love." Grimes can get far more wound up on Musk's behalf than her own, but one thing that really pisses her off is how many people think that she surrendered her agency to him. They took her silence for complicity rather than how she viewed her silence, which was not submitting to their sexist horseshit. Why should she have to respond to every scandalous thing he says? You don't think he drives her crazy too sometimes? Have you ever been in a relationship? Again, she doesn't want this to become all about Musk, but she wishes her progressive haters would show some respect for the work, for actually accomplishing their goals. He's done more than any other private citizen to wean the planet off fossil fuels. He helped protect internet service in Ukraine by making his Starlink satellite terminals available. And Grimes is baffled that so many people view his Mars ambition as some billionaire's boondoggle, rather than the essence of being human, and maybe, just maybe, the key to our survival. "The Mars project is hard," she says. "There's no income for it. There's no way for it to make money. You can't make money, after all, without customers. It's for the benefit of humanity, and it's dangerous, and it's expensive, and people are like, he's hoarding money. No, he's spending everything on R&D. She knows she can sound too admiring, and she knows it'll get her mocked. Screw it. Bro might say a lot of stupid shit, she says finally, but he does the right thing. In the days after I return home from Austin, I settle into a new morning routine. Wake up, check my phone, and read the text that Grimes sent the night before at around 2 a.m. She's as nocturnal as ever. I would literally die for a time machine, but especially for like pre-Civ type stuff, she writes, during an exchange about the earliest known tattoos. Like, man, it must have been hard. The aesthetics of that time are just like next level, like, haha, they had insanely good style. She sends a photo she found online. Like, this girl looks like she's dressed in Yeezy. She gives me fun assignments, then checks to see if I've done them. Did you read the Omega short story at the beginning of life 3.0 by Max Tegmark yet? I did. Mind blown emoji. One morning, I wake to a text about Musk. Ha ha ha, he says he'll do an interview with you, surprisingly. A week later, shortly before midnight on a Friday, Grimes calls from Musk Tesla and puts them on speakerphone. It's date night. They've got a sitter for X and Y, and they're going to the movies. An early cut of dailies by a director friend. We've got 12 minutes to talk. Musk is in the driver's seat, letting the car do the driving, and Grimes is refreshing his memory about the chorus to Player of Games, which dropped in December, and is more or less about him. If I loved him any less, I'd make him stay, but he has to be the best player of games. I wouldn't say I have to be the best player of games, Musk says. He thinks the guy and the song sounds somewhat overwrought. Grimes concedes a bit of dramatic license, but it rhymes well. He does like strategy games an awful lot, though, and she asks for permission to share that he has the top score on a popular civilization-building game called The Battle of Polytopia, which Musk describes as a much more complex version of chess. He's even bested Polytopia's creator, Felix Eckenstam. I literally beat him at his own game, Musk says. He's also lost a bunch to Eckenstam, too. Grimes and Musk agree that living separately is wise. They're just too different on the basic stuff. He likes things reasonably neat. She likes to be able to see everything she owns all at once. He likes quality design, clean aesthetics. She likes Death Note rugs from Etsy. You did have that cool vintage Japanese Metropolis poster for a bit, Grimes points out. That was yours. Oh, yeah, she says. True. As the Tesla beeps and begins to park itself, Musk sums up his position. I just don't like things to be messy in anime. When Player of Games first dropped, Grimes' fans assumed it was about her rumored split from Musk, when in fact they were welcoming their second child and spending the holidays together as a family. The idea for the song came to her during a conversation with friends 2 years ago while she was 3 or 4 months pregnant with X, when Musk casually mentioned that he planned to depart for Mars in 10 years. She froze. I was like, She remembers laughing nervously. I said, could we make it 20? It wasn't new information, Musk says in the car, lightly protesting when I bring this up. I've been saying since before she was pregnant that I was going to Mars. Sure, she replies, but I didn't know you were going like this soon. She is still trying to convince Musk to stick around longer, but either way, she came out of it with a killer song for her space opera. Player of Games isn't about their breakup. It's about going into space, sort of. For most parents, even 20 years from now would be too soon. Not for Grimes. The thing is, I effin' live and die by the mission. I believe in the mission. She'd used that phrase often, the mission, and gradually I realized it was a proper noun, uppercase M. When I asked what she meant by it, she replied without hesitation, sustainable energy, multiplanetary species, the preservation of consciousness. Last March, Grimes wrote on Instagram that she was ready to die with the red dirt of Mars beneath my feet. Now she talks as though it's a fait accompli. I will probably go when I'm like 65 or so, she tells me, the same way you might say it's always been your dream to visit the Galapagos. Hard to reach, probably out of your price range, but doable in theory. She tells me she's worried she came off ranty and cynical the previous day, when in reality she's closer to a pure idealist. This extends to AI, she says. Why is everyone so gloomy about our cybernetic future? What if AI likes humanity? What if it winds up being all of our creative best and none of our violent worst? What would that look like? I suggest later via text that her proverbial glass is 60% full, and she replies, I'm glass 90% full. Martian travel, she argues, is just another Overton window conversation. Airplanes have existed for just over a century. The space program was fighting for survival a decade ago, and yet Michael Strahan, an ex-NFL star turned morning show fixture, went to space last December. She snorts at the idea, though, of Mars as space tourism for the 0.1%. There's not going to be any makeup or postmates. It's definitely going to suck, and definitely early death for sure. Either way, she's volunteering. I'd rather die trying to do something impossible and maybe failing, she says, than just keep releasing cute pop songs. In the meantime, Grimes gets to turn the whole experience into art, and her kids get a digital age version of Jedi training. When Musk and Grimes first met, he was Tony Stark, and she was his kooky Pepper Potts. Now their domestic life is more like The Incredibles. Her role with X, she says, is handling his creative stuff. She's ready to start him on Ableton Live, the digital audio software, and she's taken him to his first rave, though he left at 11:30 p.m. Grimes has grown semi-comfortable with Musk treating X like his little captain of industry, but she says things will be different with their daughter. Quick story. In 2016, when my own daughter was 6, I took her to her first concert, Grimes opening for Florence and the Machine at the Barclays Center in Brooklyn. The next night, before the show, the FBI warned Grimes that a stalker known to them was believed to have bought a ticket and could be in the audience. This was just days after Christina Grimmie, a singer who rose to fame on The Voice, was murdered after a show by a deranged fan. Grimes played half her set that night through panic attacks, then walked off. Suffice to say, the public won't be seeing much of her daughter. The best situation here, she says, is me training the girl and him, Musk, training the boy. Y's face may be off limits to the outside world, but since date night with Musk, Grimes has been mulling whether to share her daughter's full name. She knows it'll surface eventually, and also she's proud of it. It's fire, she texts on Sunday night. Screw it, she decides. She'll do it her way. Her full name, she writes, is Exa Dark Sidereal Musk. Exa is a reference to the supercomputing term exaflops, the ability to perform 1 quintillion floating point operations per second. Dark, meanwhile, is the unknown. People fear it, but truly it's the absence of photons. Dark matter is the beautiful mystery of our universe. She texted me a voice memo with the pronunciation of sidereal, which she calls a more eleven spelling of sidereal, a more elven spelling of sidereal, the true name of the universe, star time, deep space time, not our relative Earth time. It's also a nod to her favorite Lord of the Rings character, the powerful Galadriel, who chooses to abdicate the ring. Grimes is prepared for Y to dislike her name or get tired of it. Grimes got tired of Claire a long time ago, and if she ever decides to change it, her mother will be first in line to help her choose a new one. She's already got dozens of ideas. She might even change it herself before this article comes out. In addition to Y, she and Musk occasionally call her Sailor Mars, a nod to the Sailor Moon manga series. Exa Dark Sidereal was actually something of a compromise, and she worries it's a little boring. I was fighting for Odysseus Musk, she writes. A girl named Odysseus is my dream. We speak once more by phone on the eve of Lunar New Year and discuss Mars again. I apologize to her for the cheesiness of what I'm about to ask. When you imagine your future life on Mars, is Elon there? Is he with you? Are you doing it together? Hopefully, she says, then goes quiet for a few moments. She hasn't considered this before. Wow, because, yeah, you're right. He'll probably go, and then I'll come later. Wow. Mars would still be a brutal place to live. It'd still suck, but at least E and C would be together, smashing that Overton window to bits. And if X and Y want to join their parents, they would have a free ticket waiting for them. The rocket ships would depart in synchrony with a narrow window every 2 years when Earth's orbit is the shortest distance from the red planet, tens of millions of miles away. Grimes can see it in her mind's eye now, them together on Mars, one big happy thermonuclear family. Maybe it really is all just a simulation. But it still makes her smile.
Thank you.
the prince and the predator, stripped of his titles and forced to settle a sexual abuse case, Prince Andrew is officially a royal disgrace. But the fallout from his friendship with Jeffrey Epstein might have stayed contained if not for two pivotal photos and one catastrophic TV interview by Mark Seal. Opening photo, negative creeps. Tabloid photographer Joe Donnelly chased Jeffrey Epstein and his royal houseguest into Central Park to secretly shoot these pictures. Today, some suspect Epstein wanted the photos to be taken. The tips came fast and furiously to the News of the World hotline, especially on weekends when the pubs were full and spirits ran high. We'd just sit on the features desk, and the phone would ring every 10 minutes, somebody saying, "I just had sex with a footballer on Saturday night. Give me $50,000 and I'll tell you about it," says the newspaper's infamous former deputy features editor, Paul McMullen. A sex, sin, and scandal machine, the likes of which the world had never known, the London-based tabloid had 5 million readers, 30 bloodhound reporters, and one true superstar, Maz Mahmoud, best known as the fake Sheikh. He costumed himself in Arabic robes and other disguises to entrap the rich, royal, and reprehensible on his hidden cameras. During my career at the paper, I was responsible for over 250 criminal prosecutions, he would later tell the 2011 public inquiry occasioned by the News of the World's phone hacking scandal. By then, the paper had crashed and closed. Mahmoud would be sentenced to 15 months in prison for tampering with police evidence in his drug sting of a British pop star. But the king of stings was still riding high at the end of 2010 when the tip that would rock the House of Windsor came in. Prince Andrew, Duke of York, known in the tabloids as Randy Andy, was in America, embarking upon an unofficial 4-day trip to New York City. "The royals were such a lucrative source of salacious stories," says McMullen. "Something on Prince Andrew would have made Maz salivate, especially if it had any kind of kinky sex, which was super for circulation." Mahmoud alerted Annette Withridge, a former News of the World reporter then freelancing in New York, to Andrew's visit and ask her to investigate. "Nobody knew where he was," she says. Then she remembered that Andrew had once been photographed after having lunch with the British socialite and Jeffrey Epstein confidant Ghislaine Maxwell at Nello, the paparazzi trap on Madison Avenue. Withridge found that odd. Why would Ghislaine take Andrew to a place where they were certain to be photographed, Withridge wondered. On Friday, December 3rd, 2010, Withridge began surveillance at 116 East 65th Street, Maxwell's five-story, 7,000-square-foot townhouse, which had been purchased for her by Epstein. It was freezing cold, and Withridge was bundled under 15 layers as she kept watch for Andrew in the SUV of her go-to New York-based British photographer, Jay Donnelly. As evening descended, Maxwell stepped out in a tiny skirt, a tiny jacket and boots, and got into a waiting car, Withridge told The Independent in 2019. Withridge and Donnelly raced after her, hoping to spot Andrew, because they're old friends, and I assumed if he was staying anywhere, he would be staying with Ghislaine, says Withridge. Andrew would stay at hotels, but generally he tends to stay with rich people. The chase led them through Maxwell's New York night, 40 minutes at a cocktail party in Tribeca, half an hour at a charity event on Fifth Avenue, and finally dinner at the Derby, the Meatpacking District Supper Club. Withridge followed her inside, but Andrew wasn't there. The trail had run cold. The next morning, Withridge awoke with the realization that there was only one place left to look, 9 East 71st Street, the seven-story, 40-room home of Epstein, said to be the largest single-family private residence in Manhattan. Everything led back to this mysterious Jay Gatsby-like person, Jeffrey Epstein. Prince Andrew had come to New York, it said, in search of money. His finances have repeatedly landed him in trouble. The $30,000 gold and diamond necklace given to his daughter Beatrice in 2009 by a convicted Libyan gun smuggler months before Andrew is said to have recommended him to a British company. Buckingham Palace denied the prince brokered any deal. His relationship with the controversial British businessman David Spotty Rowland, who reportedly paid off a $2 million bank loan on Andrew's behalf. The sale of his mansion, Sunninghill Park, to the son-in-law of Kazakhstan's president for $25 million, notably $4.9 million more than the asking price. And most recently, a lawsuit filed by the previous owner of the Swiss chalet Andrew and his ex-wife, Sarah Ferguson, purchased in 2014 for $23 million for missing nearly $9 million in loan payments. The couple have settled the debt. It's a deeply twisted fairy tale. The middle son of a royal family worth billions, a prince whose official annual income is $323,000, tax-free from the Queen, plus $26,000 from his 22-year service in the Royal Navy, has to hustle for extra cash. The root problem is you cannot have the sovereign's children out hunting for money. This has come back to haunt them over and over again, says a friend of Andrew's. Peripheral family members are severely underfinanced and have limited options on how commercial they can be to make money. You can't take a conventional job without leaving the family, and family duties take a massive percentage of your time. So what do you do? 62 years ago, when Andrew Albert Christian Edward was born, such a scenario would have seemed preposterous. He was the favorite from birth, the irresistible blue-eyed blonde baby boy, number one in the hearts of everyone, from Princess Diana to the Queen. He was the swashbuckling young helicopter pilot and war hero with a toothy grin and trim physique, whose public appearances were compared to Beatlemania. Girls started screaming, near hysteria gripped the tightly packed throng. He broke a million hearts when he married his princess, the feisty red-headed Fergie, in 1986, but their marriage ended after a decade, strained by his military overseas postings. The fairy tale began to crumble and crack. The toothy smile receded. The trim physique widened. The proximity to the throne diminished year by year as higher-ranking royal children were born, and Andrew, not the heir but the spare, sank from second in line to the throne at birth to ninth today. His calendar, not so full anymore, soon included visits by his old friend Maxwell, who was able to just breeze into the palace like she was one of the royal family, says former Royalty Protection Officer Paul Page, who was convicted in 2009 of running a fraudulent £3 million investment scheme from inside Buckingham Palace. We thought it was unusual because she was the daughter of the disgraced media tycoon Robert Maxwell. But that was neither here nor there to Prince Andrew. We were instructed not to put her name in the visitor's book. Now, in early December 2010, Andrew had come to New York seeking help from Epstein. It was a fool's errand from the start for the royal who'd spent most of his adult life at sea. If Epstein could play Bill Gates and Leon Black, ostensibly the smartest people on the planet, members of the royal family are easy marks compared to them, and Prince Andrew is probably the lowest-hanging fruit on the family tree, says the friend. Putting Jeffrey Epstein with Prince Andrew was like putting a rattlesnake in an aquarium with a mouse. The mouse ain't gonna win. Andrew had entered the rattlesnake's den for what turned out to be a mere $125,000. That was the amount Ferguson owed her former assistant Johnny O'Sullivan in unpaid bills and wages. That debt was a small fraction of the more than $7 million that Ferguson owed, and she was seeking a financial restructuring to stave off a potential bankruptcy proceeding. Although Andrew and Sarah divorced in 1996, they continued to live together, raised their two daughters together, and remained devoted to each other. The Duke of York, who along with his private office is masterminding the rescue plan, knows the Duchess is desperately keen to avoid bankruptcy, the Sunday Telegraph reported in August 2010. Such a move would be particularly embarrassing for him because he is the UK's special representative for international trade and development. O'Sullivan had reportedly refused to accept the 25 cents on the dollar settlement that had been offered to creditors, thereby putting the whole restructuring deal in jeopardy. Prince Andrew went to Jeffrey Epstein for help in paying that debt, says the friend. Andrew tells Epstein that his ex-wife has a real problem, and her entire restructuring is hanging in the balance with this former employee, and could he lend her some money? And Epstein says, I'll handle it directly with the employee. You don't have to pay me back. Consider it a gift. I believe Andrew assumed Epstein paid him off completely. But Epstein convinced the former employee to accept an additional $21,000 above what he was being offered as part of the restructuring. O'Sullivan did not respond to questions. Next photo, red-handed. Virginia Roberts Giuffre says Epstein took this photo of her at 17 with Prince Andrew and Ghislaine Maxwell. Andrew was in New York City, not merely meeting with Epstein, but staying at his house for 4 days. And a team from the News of the World was staked out on Epstein's doorstep, led by none other than the King of Stings, who had previously stung Ferguson in May 2010 by posing as a wealthy businessman and capturing her on a hidden camera, accepting £27,600 as part of a £500,000 deal to supposedly secure lucrative international business deals. I can open any door you want, and I will for you, she told Mahmoud on his hidden camera. Look after me, and Prince Andrew will look after you. You'll get it back tenfold. Ferguson sued Rupert Murdoch's News Corp, the parent company of News of the World, claiming her comments to Mahmoud had been taken out of context. Andrew would categorically deny any knowledge of the meeting. Ferguson withdrew the suit in 2019. Next photo, can't unsee TV. Andrew thought he could win over the public by baring his soul to the BBC's Emily Maitlis. More dangerous than the tabloid reporter outside of Epstein's mansion, however, was the predator inside. At this moment, Epstein was a year and a half out from serving 13 months in a Palm Beach, Florida jail with time free on work release after pleading guilty to 2 charges, including soliciting a minor for prostitution. It would be 9 long years before he was arrested again on July 6, 2019, and charged with sex trafficking. And the horrors of his sordid world and scores of underage victims began to come fully to light. He would be found dead in his jail cell 1 month after his arrest, presumably by suicide. But on this December day in 2010, he was a free man with a prince as his house guest. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selection by Mark Hoffman.